Bill will take that diary, clean it up a bit, and read it out loud in front of an audience. March 14th, Paris. Went with Dad to the hospital where we sat across from a man in his underpants. They were briefs, not boxers. A little on the gray side. The elastic slack from too many washings. I later said to Father, other people have to use those chairs too, you know. And he agreed that it was unsanitary. Odd little guy. Creepy. Hair on his shoulders. Big idiot smile plastered on his face. Just sitting there, mumbling to himself. How conceited I am to think that I might be remembered, especially in a busy hospital where human misery is a matter of course. If any of these people did keep a diary, their day's entry would likely have to do with a diagnosis, some piece of news either inconvenient or life-altering. The liver will not match. The cancer has spread to the spinal column. Compared to that, a man in his underpants is no more remarkable than a dust-covered plant, or the magazine subscription card lying on the floor beside the table. Then, too, good news or bad, these people would eventually leave the hospital and return to the streets, where any number of things might wipe me from their memory. Perhaps on their way home, they'd see a dog with a wooden leg, which I saw myself one afternoon. It was a German Shepherd, and his prosthesis looked as though it had been made from a billy club. The network of straps holding the leg in place was a real eye-opener. But stranger still was the noise it made against the floor of the subway car. A dull thud that managed to sound both plaintive and forceful at the same time. Then there was the dog's owner, who looked at his pet and then at me with an expression reading, "That's okay, I took care of it." Or maybe they'll run into something comparatively small, yet no less astonishing. I was walking to the bus stop one morning and came upon a well-dressed woman who was lying on the sidewalk in front of an office supply store. A small crowd had formed, and just as I joined it, a fire truck pulled up. In America, if someone dropped to the ground, you'd call for an ambulance. But in France, it's the firemen who do most of the rescuing. There were four of them, and after checking to see that the woman was okay, one of them returned to the truck and opened the door. I thought he was looking for an aluminum blanket, the type they use for people in shock, but instead he pulled out a goblet. Anywhere else, it would have been a cup made of paper or plastic, but this was glass and had a stem. I guess they carry it around in the front seat, next to the axes or whatever. The fireman filled the goblet with bottled water, and then he handed it to the woman who was sitting up now and running her hand over her hair, the way one might when waking from a nap. It was the lead story in my diary that night, but no matter how hard I fiddled with it, I felt that something was missing. Had I mentioned that it was autumn? Did the leaves on the sidewalk contribute to my sense of total happiness, or was it just the goblet and the dignity it bespoke? Yes, you may be on the ground. Yes, this drink may be your last, but let's do it right. Shall we? Everyone has his own standards, but in my opinion, a sight like that is at least 50 times better than what I was providing. A goblet will keep you going for years, while a man in his underpants is good for maybe 2 days, a week at the most. Unless, of course, you are the man in his underpants, in which case it'll probably stay with you for the rest of your life. not on the tip of your mind, not handy like a phone number, but still within easy reach, like a mouthful of steak or a dog with a wooden leg. How often you'll think of that cold plastic chair and of the nurse's face as she passes the room and discovers you with your hands between your knees. Such surprise, such amusement, as she proposes some new adventure, then stands there waiting for your decor. Undecided. I don't know that it was always this way, but for as long as I can remember, just as we move into the final weeks of the presidential campaign, the focus shifts to the undecided voters. Who are they? The news anchors ask. And how might they determine the outcome of this election? Then you'll see this man or woman, someone I always think who looks very happy to be on TV. "Well, Brian," they say, "I've gone back and forth on the issues and whatnot, but I just can't seem to make up my mind." Some insist that there's very little difference between candidate A and candidate B. Others claim that they're with A on defense and health care, but are leaning toward B when it comes to the economy. I look at these people and can't quite believe that they exist. Are they professional actors, I wonder? Or are they simply laymen who want a lot of attention? To put them in perspective, I think of being on an airplane. The flight attendant comes down the aisle with her food cart and eventually parks it beside my seat. "Can I interest you in the chicken?" she asks. "Or would you prefer the human shit with bits of broken glass in it?" To be undecided in this election is to pause for a moment and then ask how the chicken is cooked. I mean, really, what's to be confused about? When doubting that anyone could not know whom they're voting for, I inevitably think back to November 1968. Hubert Humphrey was running against Richard Nixon. When my mother couldn't choose between them, she had me do it for her. It was crazy. One minute I was eating potato chips in front of the TV, and the next I was at the fire station, waiting with people whose kids I went to school with. When it was our turn, we were led by a woman wearing a sash to one of a half dozen booths, the curtain of which closed after we entered. "Go ahead," my mother said. "Flick a switch, any switch." I looked at the panel in front of me. "Start on the judges or whatever, and we'll be here all day, so just pick a president and make it fast. We've wasted enough time already." "Which one do you think is best?" I asked. "I don't have an opinion," she told me. "That's why I'm letting you do it. Come on now, vote." I put my finger on Hubert Humphrey, and then on Richard Nixon, neither of whom meant anything to me. What I most liked about democracy, at least so far, was the booth, its quiet civility, its atmosphere of importance. I said, wondering how long we could stay before someone came and kicked us out. Ideally, my mother would have waited outside, but as she said, there was no way an unescorted 11-year-old would be allowed to vote, or even hang out, seeing as the lines were long and the polls were only open for one day. "Would you please hurry it up?" she hissed. "Wouldn't it be nice to have something like this in our living room?" I asked. "Maybe we could use the same curtains we have on our windows." "All right, that's it." My mother reached for Humphrey, but I beat her to it and cast our vote for Richard Nixon, who had the same last name as a man at our church. I assumed that the two were related and only discovered afterward that I was wrong. Richard Nixon had always been Nixon, while the man at my church had shortened his name from something funnier but considerably more foreign-sounding, Nikapapapopoulos, maybe. "Oh, well," I said. We drove back home, and when asked by my father whom she had voted for, my mother said it was none of his business. "What do you mean, none of my business?" he said. "I told you to vote Republican." "Well, maybe I did, and maybe I didn't." "You're not telling me you voted for Humphrey." He said this as if she had done something crazy, dressed like a chicken or marched through the streets with a pan on her head.
No, she said, I'm not telling you that. I'm not telling you anything. It's private, all right? My political opinions are none of your concern. What political opinions, he said. I'm the one who took you down to register. You didn't even know there was an election until I told you. Well, thanks for telling me. She turned to open a can of mushroom soup. This would be poured atop pork chops and noodles and served as our dinner, casserole style. Once we'd taken our seats at the table, my parents would stop fighting directly and continue their argument through my sisters and me. Lisa might tell a story about her day at school, and if my father said it was interesting, my mother would laugh. What's so funny? He'd say. Nothing. It's just that, well, I suppose everyone has a different standard, that's all. When my father told me that I was holding my fork wrong, my mother would say I was holding it right, or right in certain circles. We don't know how people eat the world over, she'd say, not to him, but to the buffet or the picture window, as if the statement had nothing to do with any of us. I wasn't looking forward to that kind of evening, so I told my father that I had voted. She let me, I said, and I picked Nixon. Well, at least someone in the family has some brains. He patted me on the shoulder, and as my mother turned away, I understood that I had chosen the wrong person. I didn't vote again until 1976, when I was 19 and legally registered. Because I was at college out of state, I sent my ballot through the mail. The choice that year was between Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford. I had actually seen Carter in person way back before the primaries. I liked his humility, but when the time came, I wrote in the name of Jerry Brown, who, it was rumored, liked to smoke pot. This was an issue very close to my heart, too close, obviously, as it amounted to a complete waste of a ballot. I wonder if, in the end, the undecideds aren't the biggest pessimists of all. They could order the airline chicken, but then again, isn't that adding an extra step, they ask themselves? If it's all going to be chewed up and swallowed, why not cut to the chase and go with the human shit? Ah, though, that's where the broken glass comes in.
I've been writing these little fables lately, and I thought I would start with one of them. The cat had a party to attend and went to the baboon to get herself groomed. What kind of party? The baboon asked, and she massaged the cat's neck in order to relax her, the way she did with all her customers. Hope it's not that harvest dance down on the riverbank. My sister went last year and said she'd never seen such rowdiness. Said a fight broke out between two possums and one gal, the wife of one of the other, got pushed onto a stump and knocked out four teeth. And they were pretty, too. None of this yellowness you find on most things that eat trash. The cat shuddered. No, she said, this is just a little get-together, a few friends, that type of thing. Will there be food? The baboon asked. Something, the cat sighed. I just don't know what. Of course it's hard, the baboon said. Everybody eating different things. You got one who likes leaves and another that can't stand the sight of them. Folks has gotten so picky nowadays, I just lay out some peanuts and figure they either eat them or they don't. Now, I wouldn't like a peanut, the cat said. Not at all. Well, I guess you just have drinks then. The trick is knowing when to stop. That's never been a problem for me, the cat boasted. I drink until I'm full, and then I push myself away from the table. Always have. Well, you got some sense then, not like some of them around here. The baboon picked a flea from the cat's head and stuck it gingerly between her teeth. Take this wedding I went to last Saturday, I think it was. Couple of marsh rabbits got married. You probably heard about it. The cat nodded. Not like a church service, but this was one of those write-your-own-vows types of things. Neither of them had ever picked up a pen in their life, but all of a sudden they're poets, right? Like that's all it takes is being in love. My husband and I wrote our own vows, the cat said, defensively. Sure you did, the baboon said, but you probably had something to say, not like these marsh rabbits carrying on that their love was like a tender sapling or some damn thing, and all the while they had the squirrel off to the side plucking at a harp, I think it was. I had a harp player at my wedding, the cat said. And it was lovely. I bet it was, but you probably hired a professional, someone who could really play. This squirrel, I don't think she'd ever taken a lesson in her life, just clawed at those strings, almost like she's mad at them. Well, I'm sure she tried her best, the cat said. The baboon nodded and smiled, the way one must in the service industry. She'd planned to tell a story about a drunken marsh rabbit, the brother of the groom at last week's wedding, but there was no point in it now, not with this client anyway. Whatever she said, the cat disagreed with, and unless she found a patch of common ground, she was sure to lose her tip. You know, she said, cleaning a scab off the cat's neck, I hate dogs. Simply cannot stand them. What makes you bring that up? The cat asked. Just thinking, the baboon said. Some kind of spaniel walked in yesterday asking for a shampoo, and I sent him packing. I said, I don't care how much money you have, I'm not making conversation with anyone who licks his own ass. And the moment she said it, she realized her mistake. Now, what's wrong with that? The cat said. It's good to have a clean anus. Why, I lick mine at least 5 times a day. And I admire you for it, the baboon said. But you're not a dog. Meaning? On a cat, it's classy, the baboon said. There's a grace to it, but a dog, you know the way they hunker over, legs going every which way. Well, yes, the cat said, I suppose you have a point. Then they slobber and drool all over everything, and what they don't get wet, they chew to pieces. That they do, the cat chuckled. And the baboon relaxed and searched her memory for a slanderous dog story. The collie, the German shepherd, the spaniel she claimed to have turned away. They were all good friends of hers and faithful clients, but what would it hurt to pretend otherwise and draw that fine line between licking ass and simply kissing it?
The Motherless Bear. In the 3 hours before her death, the bear's mother unearthed some acorns buried months earlier by a squirrel. They were damp and worm-eaten, as unappetizing as turds, and sighing at her rotten luck, she kicked them back into their hole. At around 10, she stopped to pull a burr from her left haunch, and then, her daughter would report, then she just died. The first few times she said these words, the bear could not believe them. Her mother, gone, how could it be? After a day, though, the shock wore off, and she tried to recapture it with an artfully placed pause and an array of amateur theatrical gestures. The faraway look was effective, and eventually she came to master it. And then, she would say, her eyes fixed on the distant horizon, then she just died. 7 times she cried,
But as the weeks passed, this became more difficult, and so she took to covering her face with her paws and doing a jerky thing with her shoulders. "There, there," friends would say, and she would imagine them returning to their families. "I saw that poor motherless bear today, and if she doesn't just break your heart, well, I don't know what will." Her neighbors brought food, more than enough to get her through the winter. So she stayed awake that year and got very fat. In the spring, the others awoke from their hibernations and found her finishing the first of the choke cherries. "Eating helps ease the pain," she explained, the bright juice dripping from her chin. And when they turned away, she followed behind them. "Did I mention to you that my mother died? We just spent a beautiful morning together, and the next thing I knew, that's no excuse for eating all our choke cherries," they said, furious. A few bears listened without interruption, but she could see in their eyes that their pity had turned to something else, boredom at best, and at worst a kind of embarrassment, not for themselves, but for her. The friend who had previously been the most sympathetic, who herself had cried upon first hearing the story, now offered a solution. "Throw yourself into a project," she said. "That's what I did after my grandfather's heart attack, and it worked wonders." "A project?" the bear said. "You know," said her friend, "dig yourself a new den or something." "But I like my den the way it is." "Then help dig one for somebody else. My ex-husband's aunt lost one of her paws in a trap and spent last winter in a ditch. Help her, why don't you?" "I hurt my paw once," the bear said. "Broke a nail clean off, and when it finally grew back, it looked like a Brazil nut." She was trying to work the subject back to herself, hoping her friend might forget her suggestion, but it didn't work. "I'll tell the old gal you'll be by later this afternoon," she said. "It'll make her happy and help you to work off some of that weight you've gained." The friend ambled off, and the bear glared at her disappearing backside. "Help you work off some of that weight you gained," she mimicked. Then she overturned a log and ate some ants, low-calorie ones with stripes on their butts. After that, she lay in the sun and was sound asleep when her friend returned and shook her awake, saying, "What's wrong with you? Huh? It's almost dark, and my ex-husband's aunt has been waiting all day." "Right," said the bear, and she headed up the hill, deciding after a few dozen yards that this was not going to happen. Forget following advice she had never asked for in the first place. Rather than digging a den for a stranger, someone old who was just going to die anyway, she'd leave home and settle on the other side of the mountain. There she could meet some new bears, strangers, who would listen to her story and allow her once again to feel tragic. The following morning she set out, taking care to avoid the old amputee, who still sat waiting beside her wretched ditch. Beyond a burned-out grove of birch trees, there was a stream, and following it, she came upon a cub who sat waist-deep in the rushing water, swatting at fish with his untrained paws. "I used to do the same thing when I was your age," called the bear, and the cub looked up and let out a cry of surprise. "I must have sat in the water all morning until my mother came over and showed me how to catch fish properly." She waited a beat and then continued. "Of course, that could never happen now. And you know why?" The cub said nothing. "It couldn't happen now because my mother is dead," the bear announced. "Happened suddenly, when I least expected it. One moment she was there, and the next she just wasn't." The cub began to whimper. "You wake up an orphan, your mom's body slowly rotting beside you? And what can you do but soldier on, all alone, with no one to love or protect you?" As the cub began to wail, his mother charged out of the thicket. "What are you, sick?" she shouted. "Get your kick scaring innocent children? Is that it? Go on now, get the hell out of here." The bear ran to the opposite shore and into the forest, tripping on logs as she turned to look behind her. What with her weight, she was soon out of breath. So she slowed to a trot after the first 100 yards, her pace gradually degenerating as the morning turned to afternoon and then early evening. Just before dusk, she smelled chimney smoke and ambled to the outskirts of a village. Peering through a gap in a thick hedge, she saw a crowd of humans standing with their backs to her. They seemed to be regarding something that stood in a clearing, and when one of them shifted position, she saw that it was a bear, a male, though it took a moment to realize it, as he was wearing a skirt and a tall, cone-shaped hat topped with a satin scarf. The male bear's mouth was muzzled with leather straps and connected to a leash, which was alternately held and yanked by a man in a dirty cape. A boy, who was also dressed in a cape, carried a drum on a rope around his neck, and as he began to play, the male stood on his hind legs and swayed back and forth to the music. "Faster!" called a soldier at the front of the crowd, and the boy quickened his beat. The male bear struggled to keep up, and when he tripped over the hem of his skirt, the man pulled out a stick and beat him across the face until his nose bled. This made the people laugh, and a few of them threw coins, which the drummer collected before moving on to his next song. When night fell and the audience went home to their suppers, the man removed the muzzle from the male's snout. Then he put a collar around his neck and attached it by a chain to an iron stake driven deep into the ground. He and the boy retired to a tent, and when she was sure they had fallen asleep, the bear crept out from behind the hedge and approached the chained dancer. "I don't normally talk to strangers," she said, "but I saw you here and figured, well, I guess there's a first time for everything." The male was lying in an awkward position. His skirt was gathered around his waist, and she saw that great patches of his legs were without hair, and that the skin in these areas was covered with open sores. "I used to talk a lot to my mother," she told him. "She and I were all each other had, and then one morning, out of nowhere, she just died. Gone. Before I could even say goodbye or anything." Maybe it was the moonlight. Maybe it was the excitement of meeting an entertainer. But for whatever reason, she actually managed a tear, her first in almost 6 months. It was running slowly down her cheek when the chained male raised his head and spoke.
"Can you understand me?" he asked.
The bear nodded, though in fact it was quite difficult.
"That's good," he said. "Most animals can't make out a word I'm saying, and do you know why?"
She shook her head.
"It's because I have no teeth," he said. "Not a one of them. The man in the tent took a rock and hammered them out of my head."
"But the muzzle," the bear said.
"That's just to make me look dangerous."
"Oh," the bear said, "I get it."
"No," he told her, "I don't think you do. See, I have maggots living in my knees. I'm alive, but flies are raising families in my flesh, okay?"
The bear shivered at the thought of it.
"It's been years since I've eaten solid food. My digestive system is shot. My right foot is broken in 3 places, and you're coming to me all teary-eyed because your stepmother died?"
"She wasn't a step," the bear said.
"Oh, she was too. I can see it in your eyes."
"Well, she was just like a real mother," the bear said.
"Yeah, and piss is just like honey if you're hungry enough."
"Maybe males in this part of the country say every ugly thing that enters their heads," the bear said, "but where I'm from..." That was as far as she got, before the man and the boy came up from behind and hit her over the head with a padded club. When she came to, it was morning, and the male lay on the ground before her, his throat slit into a meaty smile. "He wasn't no good to us anyway," the man said to his assistant. "The knees go, and that's that." Now the bear travels from village to village. Her jaws are sunken, her gums swollen with the abscesses left by broken teeth, and between the disfigurement and the muzzle, it's nearly impossible to catch what she's saying. Always, though, while tripping and stumbling to the music, she looks out into her audience and tells the story about her mother. Most people laugh and yell for her to lift her skirts, but every so often she'll spot someone weeping and swear they can understand her every word. The Faithful Setter. Back before I met her, my wife lived on a farm. It was a small operation, organic vegetables, pick-your-own strawberries, and a dozen or so chickens, each and every one of them, to hear her tell it, an absolute raging asshole. The first time she said this, I laughed, as I'd always thought that word was reserved for males. The same goes for dick, which she uses for females all the time, this raccoon, for example, that sometimes gets into our garbage cans. "Can you believe the nerve of that dick?" she'll say to me, her nose pressed flat against the dining room window. Then she'll bark, "Hey, asshole, go trash somebody else's fucking yard." I attribute my wife's language to the fact that she's one quarter spaniel. She says she's only an eighth, but come on, the ears say it all. That and her mouth. Still, though, I can't help but love her, forgave her even after she cheated. "They are two your children," she'd said, referring to her last litter, a party of four that looked no more like me than that dick of a raccoon. I knew they were fathered by the English bull terrier across the street, but what are you going to do? Everyone's entitled to one mistake, aren't they? I'd like to tell you that I hated this terrier right from the start, that I'd never for one moment trusted him. But what would that say about my wife and me, that our tastes are that dissimilar? If you want to know the truth about it, I actually hadn't given the guy much thought. His ugliness, I'd noticed, sure, those creepy little eyes. His stupidity was evident as well, but I can't say I'd fashioned a formal opinion, at least not until this puppy business. The litter was born, and not 1 week later, the bull terrier bit a kid in the face, practically tore it right off, as a matter of fact. It was a little blonde girl who lived in the house next door to him. I was in the back seat of the car, just pulling into the driveway when the ambulance arrived, and man, was that ever a scene. The parents were beside themselves. "Oh, well," my wife yawned when I told her about it later that afternoon. "It's not like they can't have more children." I said, "Come again?" She said, "That's the way they feel about us, so why should we be any different?" "So we need to stoop to their level," I said. As for the bull terrier, my wife admitted that he was a hothead. She said he had a lousy sense of humor, but she never quite denounced him the way I needed her to. After he was trundled away and put down, she spent the day sulking. "A headache," she said to the kids. "Mommy has a sick headache." She claimed to have one the following day as well, on and on for a week, and all the while she had her eye on the house across the street, the place where her boyfriend had lived. It wasn't long afterward that the little girl came home from the hospital, her head cocooned in bandages. There were holes for her to look through, and others for her nose and mouth, all of them gunked up with their corresponding fluids, tears, snot, drool. Even if you hated children, you had to feel sorry for her. At least I thought you had to. My wife, though, I could see that she blamed this girl, thinking that were it not for her, the bull terrier would still be alive. I figured she'd get over him eventually, and in the meantime, I'd just settle back and be patient. It helped when our owner put an ad in the paper and got rid of those godforsaken puppies. Oh, sure, I cried, but it was more for my wife than for myself. I don't care what you hear about step-parenting. It's just not the same when they're somebody else's kids. Don't get me wrong, I wish them the best. I just don't feel the need to see them again. Now that it was just the two of us, I hoped that things would return to normal. It was then that our owner took my wife in for a hysterectomy. She was out cold for the operation, saw nothing, felt nothing, went to sleep fertile and woke up a shell, her uterus and whatever else was in there, gone. I told her that as far as I was concerned, it didn't matter in the least. To this she growled, "Oh, I'm sure it doesn't. I'm sure you're just fine with it." I said, "What are you talking about? You're thinking that this will keep me from cheating on you again, or that if I do, at least nothing will come of it." It was like she was blaming me for the hysterectomy. I said, "Baby, don't do this." She didn't talk to me for 3 days after that. What was going through her mind is anyone's guess. Me, though, I kept thinking about this Weimaraner I met once at the dog run. He had one of those owners who'd get down on all fours and try to communicate with him, not just barking, but lying on his back, acting submissive and so forth. There are quite a few people like that at the dog run. Nuts is what they are. But this guy really took the cake. One morning last fall, he went to the hospital and had his tonsils taken out. They weren't raw or swollen or anything. He just wanted them. "In a jar," he supposedly told the doctor, "and don't trim off the fat." At the end of the day, he returned home, cut the tonsils into pieces with a steak knife, and hand-fed them to this Weimaraner, like, "Here, boy, I love you so much. I want you to have a part of me." "And?" I said. "It was a lot like chicken," the Weimaraner told me. So that's what I wondered during the time my wife and I weren't talking. What did her hysterectomy taste like? It was crazy, I know, but I couldn't get it out of my mind. Did my thoughts bespeak an urge towards cannibalism? Or did the flesh in question, the fact that it was her uterus, reduce this to a normal sexual fantasy? I would have liked to have discussed it, but the way things stood, I thought it best to keep my mouth shut. It was right about then, my wife wanting her boyfriend back and me entertaining these insane dark thoughts, that the bandaged girl reappeared. It seemed there were some complications, an infection or something, and she had to go back to the hospital. We saw her through the living room window, just briefly getting into the car with her parents. "Little Miss Priss," my wife muttered, the first words out of her mouth in what felt like forever. Then she limped into the den and lay down in front of the TV. This is her way of being alone, as I hate the television. The programs are beside the point. It's the machine itself I can't bear. Stinks to high heaven, so I always stop at the doorway and park myself just this side of the carpet. "That's right, Mr. Snob," my wife said. She always calls me that when we disagree about something, whether it's a chew toy or the smell of an electrical appliance. "I guess I'm just not as well-bred as you," she'll say. And it's true, she's not. It's also true that she's the one forever bringing it up. It's her own insecurity talking, the tragic self-hatred of a mixed-breed country girl. So I try to let it slide. My wife mentions my bloodline when she's ticked off, of course, and then again whenever I get sent out on a stud call, which is not the same as cheating, I don't care what you hear. Infidelity involves a choice, while this is arranged by forces beyond my control. "These females don't want me any more than I want them," I tell my wife. "It's not an affair, it's work, it's my job, for God's sake." She says that if it's a paycheck I'm after, I could just as easily lug around a blind person. Or better yet, sniff out contraband. You and that selective nose that hates a TV but loves the smell of a book. "Not all books," I tell her, and it's true. I can't stand thrillers. It was in the midst of our difficulties, my wife's stitches still tender, that I was sent to service a female a few hours west of our home. Normally, it's just hello, goodbye, but the land is beautiful in that part of the world. It's wooded with lots of hills, so rather than waiting for me to finish, my owner decided to drop me off and spend the rest of the day nosing around in his car. The act itself, it's hard to think of it as sex, lasted no more than a minute. Then this female and I got to talking. She's pure Irish setter, just like me, so we had that in common. Both of us had hookworms when we were young, and both of us, very coincidentally, love the taste and texture of candles. "As long as they're not scented," she said. "The worst are those cheap vanilla candles," I offered. She agreed, adding that the cheap part was redundant. All vanilla-scented candles are cheap. I told her about a cinnamon-scented candle I'd once chewed on as a puppy, and as she howled her sympathetic disgust, I thought of my wife and of how we would have sounded to her ears. Arrogant, she'd have called us. Noses so high in the air you can't smell your own farts. This for the crime of preferring one thing over another. You know what else I hate, I said to the female. I hate air fresheners, coconut being the worst. Well, I don't know, she said. I think a pretty good case could be built against wild cherry. Oh my God, wild cherry, I said, and I hunched my shoulders, pretending to barf. From air fresheners, we wandered on to padded toilet seats, novelty mailboxes, and labradoodles. She just started in on light jazz when I suggested we try the breeding thing one more time, in case the first go didn't work. Don't have to ask me twice, she said. I didn't have to ask at all for round three, and the one after that just seemed to happen on its own. An aftershock, the female called it. Some might define this as cheating, but I just call it being thorough. Then, too, I was completely upfront about my marital status, practically from the start. Your wife, the female said. So how did that happen? I told her we were married by my owner's girlfriend, now former girlfriend, I said. I don't know how binding it is, but I wouldn't want to be with anyone else. And it's true, I wouldn't. Among other things, I like the fact that my wife needs me. Without my guidance, she's sure to finish what her boyfriend started. The child across the street will be mangled even worse. And for what? This is not you, I keep telling her. For now, though, it's as if she's under a spell. I explained this to the female as best as I could, and after I'd finished, she cocked her head. So your wife was brainwashed by an English bull terrier? Something like that. God, she said, I hate English bull terriers. That was when we had the aftershock. It was almost dusk when the owner arrived, and he and I headed off for home. The air conditioner was on, but after some whining, I got him to lower the window. I had my head out, and we'd been on the road for no more than 20 minutes when we came upon a burning building. It was a house, 3 stories tall, with a low brick wall around it. The owner pulled over, and before he could stop me, I jumped over the seat and joined him on the grass. Had my wife been with me, he'd have forced us back into the car, but I'm pretty reliable, even without a leash. Besides, I make him look good, much more interesting than he actually is. A small crowd had begun to gather, encircling a barefoot woman with sweatpants on. As we moved closer, I saw that she was holding a dachshund, the type with long hair. Everyone watched as she pushed back his ears, repeatedly kissing his forehead while he twisted and begged to be let down. It was only when an old man arrived and gathered the woman in an embrace that the dog broke free. He and I got to talking, and I learned he was the single thing this woman had reached for when she smelled the smoke and realized that her house was on fire. Which is nice and everything, don't get me wrong, the dachshund said, but she's got a teenage son in there. He gestured toward a second-floor window with black smoke pouring out of it. He and his mother were constantly at each other's throats, but he was always nice to me, poor kid. The dachshund let out a sigh, and as the woman reached down to snatch him back up, I caught a glimpse of the poor guy's future. I could have saved anything, and I chose you. Who wants to live with that kind of pressure? As I wished him good luck, the firemen arrived. A group of 3 headed toward the house and were almost there when a part of the roof collapsed. Sparks shot into the darkening sky, and as they sputtered down to earth, I caught the scent of burning flesh and realized how hungry I was. With any luck, the owner would stop on our way home and buy us each a hamburger wrapped in paper. Then, smelling of smoke and ketchup, I'd return to my hangdog wife and continue the long business of loving her. Dentists Without Borders.
One thing that puzzled me during the American healthcare debate was all the talk about socialized medicine and how ineffective it's supposed to be. The Canadian plan was likened to genocide. But even worse were the ones in Europe, where patients languished on filthy cots, waiting for aspirin to be invented. I don't know where these people get their ideas, but my experiences in France, where I've lived off and on for the last 13 years, have all been good. A house call in Paris will run you around $50. I was tempted to arrange one the last time I had a kidney stone, but waiting even 10 minutes seemed out of the question. So instead, I took the subway to the nearest hospital. In the center of town, where we're lucky enough to have an apartment, most of my needs are within arm's reach. There's a pharmacy right around the corner. And two blocks further is the office of my physician, Dr. Medioni. Twice I've called on a Saturday morning, and after answering the phone himself, he's told me to come on over. These visits, too, cost $50. The last time I went, I had a red thunderbolt bisecting my left eyeball. The doctor looked at it for a moment, and then he took a seat behind his desk. "I wouldn't worry about it if I were you," he said. "Thing like that. It should be gone in a day or two." "Where did it come from?" I asked. "How did I get it?" "How do we get most things?" he answered. "We buy them." The time before that, I was lying in bed and found a lump on my right side, just below my rib cage. It was like a deviled egg tucked beneath my skin. Cancer, I thought. A phone call, and 20 minutes later, I was stretched out on the examining table with my shirt raised. "Oh, that's nothing," the doctor said. "Little fatty tumor. Dogs get them all the time." I thought of other things dogs have that I don't want. Dew claws, for example. Hookworms. "Can I have it removed?" "I guess you could, but why would you want to?" He made me feel vain and frivolous for even thinking about it. "You're right," I told him. "I'll just pull my bathing suit up a little higher." When I asked if the tumor would get any bigger, the doctor gave it a gentle squeeze. "Bigger? Sure, probably." "Will it get a lot bigger?" "No." "Why not?" I asked. And he said, sounding suddenly weary, "I don't know." "Why don't trees touch the sky?" Medioni works from an apartment on the third floor of a handsome 19th century building. And on leaving, I always think, wait a minute, did I see a diploma on his wall? Could doctor possibly be the man's first name? He's not indifferent. It's just that I expect a little something more than it'll go away. The thunderbolt cleared up just as he said it would, and I've since met dozens of people who have fatty tumors and get along just fine. Maybe, being American, I want bigger names for things. I also expect a bit more gravity. I've run some tests, I'd like to hear, and discovered that what you have is called a bilateral ganglial abasement, or in layman's terms, a cartoidal rupture of the venal septumus. Dogs get these things all the time. And most often they die. That's why I'd like us to proceed with the utmost caution. For my $50, I want to leave the doctor's office in tears. But instead, I walk out feeling like a hypochondriac, which was one of the few things I'm actually not. If my French physician is a little disappointing, my French periodontist more than makes up for it. I have nothing but good things to say about Dr. Gieg, who gum-wise has really brought me back from the abyss. Twice in the course of our decade-long relationship, he's performed surgical interventions. Then, last year, he removed four of my lower incisors, drilled down into my jawbone, and cemented in place two posts. First, though, he sat me down and explained the procedure, using lots of big words that allowed me to feel tragic and important. I'm going to perform the surgery at 9 o'clock on Tuesday morning, and it should take at most 3 hours, he said. All of this, as usual, in French. At 6 that evening, you'll go to the dentist for your temporary implants, but still, I'd like for you to block out that entire day. I said to Hugh when I got home, where did he think I was going to go with 4 missing teeth? I see Dr. Gieg for surgery and consultations, but the regular twice-a-year deep cleanings are performed by his associate, a woman named Dr. Barras. What she does in my mouth is unspeakable. And because it causes me to sweat, I've taken to bringing a second set of clothes and changing in the bathroom before I leave for home. Oh, Mr. Sedaris, she chuckles, you were such a child. A year ago, I arrived and announced that since my previous visit, I'd been flossing every night. I thought this might elicit some praise, how dedicated you are, how disciplined, but instead she said, oh, there's no need. It was the same when I complained about all the gaps between my teeth. I had braces when I was young, but maybe I need them again, I told her. An American dentist would have referred me to an orthodontist, but to Dr. Barras, I was just being hysterical. You have what we in France call good time teeth, she said. Why on earth would you want to change them? Because I can floss with the sash to my bathrobe. Hey, she said, enough with the flossing. You have better ways to spend your evenings. I guess that's where the good times come in. Dr. Barras has a sick mother and a long-haired cat named Andy. As I lay there sweating with my trap wide open, she runs her electric hook under my gum line and catches me up on her life since my last visit. I always leave with a mouthful of blood, yet I always look forward to my next appointment. She and Dr. Gieg are my people, completely independent of Hugh. And though it's a stretch to label them friends, I think they'd miss me if I died of a fatty tumor. Something similar is happening with my dentist, Dr. Granon. He didn't fabricate my implants, that was the work of someone else, but he took the molds and made certain that the teeth fit the way they were supposed to. This was done during 5 visits in the winter of 2011. Once a week, I'd show up at the office and climb into his reclining chair. Then I'd sink back with my mouth open. Ça va, he'd ask every 5 minutes or so, meaning all right. And I'd release a little tone like a doorbell. Implants come in 2 stages. The first teeth that get screwed in, the temporaries, are blocky and the color is off. The second ones are more refined and are somehow dyed or painted to match their neighbors. My 4 false incisors are connected to form a single unit and were secured into place with an actual screwdriver. Because the teeth affect one's bite, the positioning has to be exact. So my dentist would put them in and then remove them to make a minor adjustment. Put them in, take them out, over and over. All the pain was behind me by this point, and so I just lay there trying to be a good patient. Dr. Renaud keeps a small muted television mounted near the ceiling, and each time I come, it is tuned to the French travel channel. Voyage, it's called. Once I watched a group of mountain people decorate a yak. They didn't string lights on it, but everything else seemed fair game. Ribbons, bells, silver sheaths for the tips of its horns. Ça va? Another week, we were somewhere in Africa where a family of 5 dug into the ground and unearthed what looked to be a burrow full of mice. Dr. Granat's assistant came into the room to ask a question, and when I looked back at the screen, the mice had been skinned and placed kebab-like on sharp sticks. Then came another distraction, and when I looked up again, the family in Africa were grilling the mice over a campfire and eating them with their fingers. "Ça va?" Dr. Grenat asked, and I raised my hand. International dental sign language for "there is something vital I need to communicate." He removed his screwdriver from my mouth and I pointed to the screen. "Ils ont mangé des souris en brochette," I told him, meaning they have eaten some mice on skewers. He looked up at the little TV. "Are we?" A regular viewer of the Travel Channel, nothing surprises Dr. Grenat. He has seen it all and is quite the traveler himself. As is Dr. Geig. Dr. Barras hasn't gone anywhere exciting lately, but what with her mother, how can she? With all these dental professionals in my life, you'd think I'd look a little less like a jack-o'-lantern. You'd think I could bite into an ear of corn, or at least tear meat from a chicken bone, but that won't happen for another few years. Not until we tackle my two front teeth and the wobbly second incisors that flank them. "But after that's done, I'll still need to come regularly, won't I?" I said to Dr. Geig, almost panicked. "My gum disease isn't cured, is it?" I've gone from avoiding dentists and periodontists to practically stalking them. Not in some quest for a Hollywood smile, but because I enjoy their company. I'm happy in their waiting rooms, the coffee tables heaped with Gala and Madame Figaro. I like their mumbled French, spoken from behind Tyvek masks. None of them ever call me David, no matter how often I invite them to. Rather, I am Mr. Sedaris. Not my father, but the smaller continental model. Mr. Sedaris with the 4 lower implants. Mr. Sedaris with the good time teeth. Sweating so fiercely, he leaves the office 2 kilos lighter. That's me pointing to the bathroom and asking the receptionist if I may use the sandbox. Me traipsing down the stairs in a fresh set of clothes, my smile bittersweet and drearied with blood, counting the days until I can come back and return myself to their curious, socialized care. Memory lapse. I always told myself that when I hit 50, I was going to discover opera. Not just casually, but full force. Studying the composers, learning Italian, maybe even buying a cape. It seemed like something an older person could really sink his teeth into. That's why I put it off for so long. Then I turned 50, and instead of opera, I discovered swimming. Or rather, I rediscovered swimming. I've known how to do it since I was 10 and took lessons at the Raleigh Country Club. There was a better place, the Carolina Country Club, but I don't believe they admitted Yankees. Jews either, if my memory serves me correctly. The only blacks I recall were employees, and they were known to everyone, even children, by their first names. The man behind the bar was Ike. You were 11-year-old Mr. Sedaris. The Better Country Club operated on the principle that Raleigh mattered, that its old families were fine ones, and that they needed a place where they could enjoy one another's company without being pawed at. Had we not found this laughable, our country club might have felt desperate. Instead, its attitude was, "Look how much money you saved by not being good enough." I can't speak for the two clubs' golf courses, but their pools were the same size. And on a hot, windless afternoon, you could probably smell them from an equal distance. Chlorine pits is what they were. Chemical baths. In the deep end, my sisters and I would dive for nickels. Toss one in, and by the time we reached it, half of Jefferson's face would be eaten away. Come lunchtime, we'd line up at the snack bar, our hair the texture of cotton candy,
our small, burning eyes like little cranberries. My lessons were taken in June 1966, the first year of our membership. By the following summer, I was on the swim team. This sounds like an accomplishment, but I believe that in 1967, anyone could be on the Raleigh Country Club team. All you had to do was show up and wear an orange Speedo. Before my first practice, I put swimming in the same category as walking and riding a bike, things one did to get from place to place. I never thought of how well I was doing them. It was only in competing that an activity became fraught and self-conscious. More accurately, it was only in competing with boys. I was fine against girls, especially if they were younger than me. Younger than me and physically challenged was even better. Give me a female opponent with a first-grade education and a leg brace, and I would churn that water like a speedboat. When it came to winning, I never split hairs. Most of my ribbons were for good sportsmanship, a backhanded compliment if ever there was one. As the starting gun was raised, I would look at my competitors, twitching at their places. Parents would shout their boozy encouragement from the sidelines, and it would occur to me that one of us would have to lose, that I could do that for these people. For whether I placed or came in last, all I ultimately felt was relief. The race was over, and now I could go home. Then the next meet would be announced, and it would start again. The sleepless nights, the stomach aches, a crippling and all-encompassing sense of doom. My sisters Lisa and Gretchen were on the team as well, but I don't think it bothered them as much. For me, every meet day was the same. "Mom," this said with a groan like someone calling out from beneath a boulder, "I don't feel too good. Maybe we should—" "Oh, no, you don't." If I'd been trying to get out of school, she'd at least have allowed me to plead my case, but then she had no presence at school. At the club, she was front and center, laughing it up with Ike at the bar and with the girls in the restaurant beside the putting green. Once summer got going, we'd spend all day at the pool, us swimming and her broasting on one of the deck chairs. Every so often, she'd go into the water to cool off, but she didn't know how to swim and didn't trust us not to drag her under. So she'd sit waist deep in the kiddie pool, dropping her cigarette ash onto the wet pavement and dissolving it with her finger. There was a good-sized group of women like her, and they were united in their desire to be left alone. Run to your mother with a complaint, and before she could speak, one of the others would say, "Oh, come on now, let's not be a tattletale." Or, "You would have lost that tooth anyway, now get back into the water." I think of them in that terrible heat, no umbrellas, just sunglasses, and bottles of tanning oil that left them smelling like coconuts. The pool was a land of women and children until swim meets, which usually started at 6. Then drinks would be ordered and the dads would arrive. For most of the fathers, this was just one more thing they had to turn up for. Their son was likely on his school's football or basketball team. Maybe he played baseball as well. For my dad, though, this was it. And the way I saw it, he should have been grateful. Look at all the time my fear of sports was affording him. Weekends and evenings free. In retrospect, I was never an awful swimmer, just average. I'd come in third sometimes, or once or twice if I was part of a relay team, we'd place first, though I could hardly take credit. Occasionally, we'd have intra-club races, us against us. And in those, as in the larger meets, the star was a boy named Greg Sackis, who was my size but a few years younger, with pale yellow hair and legs no thicker than jumper cables. "God, that Greg Sackis, did you see him go?" my father said on the way home from my first meet. "Man alive, that kid is fantastic." In the beginning, it didn't bother me. Greg wasn't stuck up. His father was decent enough, and everyone adored his mother. She was one of the few moms who could get away with wearing a bikini, a chocolate-colored one that, as the summer advanced, made it look as if she were naked. "That son of yours is really something," I heard my father say to her after our second meet. "You ought to bring a movie camera out here and film him." On the way home, he repeated the conversation to my mother. I said to her, "Send that footage to a professional swimming coach and he'll be champing at the bit."
Your boy's a real thing. Olympic material, I'm telling you. He's got speed, personality, the whole package. Okay, I thought. You can shut up about Greg Sakis now. We had a station wagon at the time, and my sister Gretchen and I were in what we called the way back, the spot where groceries usually went. When she was a baby, a dog bit her face and left her with a scar that was almost invisible until she got a tan. Then it looked like someone had chalked the number 1 4 times on her cheek and put a strike mark through it. It's a kid swimming against him, I feel sorry for, my father continued. Those clowns didn't stand a chance. And did you hear what he said when they handed him his blue ribbon? Who the hell knew Greg Sakis could be so funny? Good looking, too. Just an all-around 4-star individual. When she was young, my sister was what we called chunky. And the longer my dad carried on about Greg, the better it seemed to draw attention to it. Hey, I called. Gretchen's in a sunbeam. Does anyone else smell bacon frying? My sister looked at me like, weren't we friends just 2 minutes ago? Where is